And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about something which, particularly in certain circles, has almost become something of a dirty word. And that word is flexibility. And we seem to live in a world now in which to say that somebody is flexible might very well be meant as an insult, as an indictment, as a sense that this is a person who is easily swayed, who does not stand for anything, who is not firmly committed to the bedrock beliefs of their life. And yet, of course, this is a terrible way to think about flexibility. And certainly that is the contention of my morning show guest, a clinical psychologist by the name of Dr. Ross White, who believes, and I think with good reason, that flexibility is one of the most essential skills to being fully human, and more importantly, to thriving in a complicated world. And that is what he explores in a very intriguing new book called The Tree That Bends: How a Flexible Mind Can Help You Thrive, published by Quirkus, which is a division of Hachette, the British version of Hachette Publishing. And there is a lot that is very much intriguing in this book, a book that is thoughtfully written and obviously very carefully conceived. And I'm very excited to speak with Dr. White about this book. Once again, it's titled The Tree That Bends: How a Flexible Mind Can Help You Thrive. Dr. Ross White, we welcome you to the morning show.
Pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the invite.
I want to give you a chance to talk about this notion of flexibility as something that in this current environment can sometimes be wielded as an insult. And of course, I am American, speaking to you from Wisconsin. You are speaking to me from Britain, but I think in both of these nations, we are talking about a political landscape fraught with a lot of division, and I think you are probably well acquainted with what I am talking about. Did that in any way prompt you to want to write this book, this notion that the quality of flexibility is not seen as a strength?
It's a great question, and I think it's important really to talk about the type of flexibility that I'm referring to in the book. And it's very specifically a concept called psychological flexibility. Okay. And I like to think about psychological flexibility as psychological jiu-jitsu. And I am someone who has practiced martial arts, particularly Japanese jiu-jitsu, as opposed to its more contemporary Brazilian variant that is very popular across the world. So jiu-jitsu is literally translated as the yielding art, yielding. And I think that's a really important concept. And I think it speaks to the issue that you're highlighting, that when we think about the idea of yielding, it almost sounds like we are caving in, we are being compliant, or we're flip-flopping, and then we're surrendering, we're being weak. And I think jiu-jitsu teaches us that yielding is about taking some of the momentum that could be directed at us and using that to help us to transform, to really prevail. So in jiu-jitsu, if your opponent uses momentum and energy against you, you pivot, and you in turn transform that energy so that you can prevail and come through. And I think that's a really important idea for us and how we might deal with our own thoughts and our own feelings. COVID-19, the pandemic, was supposed to be a new beginning. We were looking to readjust and to look at our work-life balance or work-life blend. But actually, the data suggests that rates of burnout have increased since COVID, that the number of hours that we're working has increased since COVID. And to some extent, the blurring of the division between work and life has contributed to that. So we're in a place where we're struggling with some of the difficult emotions that show up in life, and that we can get into patterns of quite rigid patterns of trying to suppress, avoid, get rid of those thoughts and feelings. If I said to you, don't think about a pink elephant, what do you end up thinking about, right? If I say to you, don't think about that thing that you're really worried about, right? It serves to keep it on the radar and indeed increases rather than decreases the impact that it has on you. So psychological flexibility is this ability to harness some of the energy that comes with those thoughts and feelings, to not suppress them or try to get rid of them, because that can be counterproductive, but instead to shift the relationship we have with them so that they no longer block us doing the things that are important to us. So psychological flexibility is the ability to have difficult thoughts and feelings and still do the things that matter to you. And I think in our contemporary times, I think that's a very important skill set to have, whether it's dealing with stresses and strains caused by work or some of the political strife and the turmoil that we're facing and the uncertainty that that brings. So yeah, I think psychological flexibility is very much of this time.
Having said that, I'm curious to what extent this has been a long-term understanding of yours, and are you just reframing it, describing it in different terms, or do you feel like in recent years, since COVID, with the rise of a certain kind of political turmoil, among other stresses that so many of us are feeling, have you really come to see this and understand this in a way that you did not understand 10 years ago, or perhaps didn't even much think about 10 years ago?
So I've been using these approaches for 15 years, and the work, the book, The Tree That Bends, draws on an approach called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is ACT rather than ACT. It's known as ACT, the word. And I recognize the importance of ACT and building people's psychological flexibility in the clinical work that I do. And I work with business executives, I work with athletes, people working in high pressure environments, to help them develop that psychological flexibility so that they can thrive. And thrive is about, excel, do well in what you're doing, but also feel well. Because we can see that over this last number of years, some of the messaging almost suggests that we should sacrifice ourselves at the altar of wanting to succeed in life. And it became very clear to me that it wasn't a zero-sum game, that I needed to communicate that message to broader audiences. And that really motivated me to write the book. And the title of the book, The Tree That Bends, comes from a Tanzanian proverb: the wind does not break the tree that bends. And I've been fortunate to work in sub-Saharan Africa with colleagues around mental health and well-being. And that's when I learned about this metaphor, and it stayed with me. And I think, Greg, that nature is a teacher. And when we look to nature, we can learn a lot about what it takes to thrive. So I use the tree as a central metaphor to represent psychological flexibility in the book. And if you think about it, trees, they've got their get mode. They need to get busy capturing the sun's energy to create the fuel that it needs to grow. So it has its get mode. It has its threat mode. It needs to be responsive in storms. It needs to have that elasticity to absorb the wind's energy so it can come back to center. It also needs to protect itself from infestation, from bugs or fungi that can kill the tree. So trees have their threat mode. Trees also have a reset mode. In autumn, winter, they drop their leaves so that they can then get revitalized to go again in the spring. So trees have their get, threat, and reset mode. I think we absolutely do too. And in modern life, I would argue that our get mode and our threat mode are really highly activated. And you only have to look at the news, right, to get a sense of how activated our threat mode might be. And our reset mode is unfortunately the poor cousin. So we need to be purposeful in trying to activate that reset mode. And that's about taking care of ourselves, taking care of those that we love, by connecting with nature, connecting with something that's more vast than ourselves, expressing gratitude for the small things in life that do make a difference for us. And psychological flexibility is the process that allows us to move flexibly between the get mode, when we do need to pursue our goals, when we have to go into threat mode to respond appropriately to danger, and importantly, to help us to get into that reset mode. Mm.
And of course, one of the other points that your book makes is that a tree is a beautiful symbol or metaphor for what our lives should be, because you have not only the part of the tree that we immediately see, that part that is indeed flexible when it needs to be, but that a tree is also about what is beneath the surface, the anchoring of roots, and that sense of being anchored, that sense of personal foundation is part of what, of course, makes the flexibility above the ground possible. Tell us what you see as the corollary in a person's life to the roots of a tree, to that sense of foundation.
It's a fantastic question, and it's one that I spend some time in the book exploring. So it's not just about how a tree functions that can be the metaphor. It's the anatomy of the tree that can be really helpful for us in understanding how we bring that flexibility into our day-to-day life. So I take three elements of the tree, and you rightly start with the roots, which represent our ability to be anchored. And what do I mean by being anchored? Well, I mean being in the here and now, literally in the place and time in which life is unfolding, where I can actively make choices. Too often in modern life, we are mentally time traveling to past regrets or to future worries. There's some really lovely research that indicates for almost half of our waking hours, we are not actively thinking about what is happening around us. We're doing that mental time travel thing. So anchored is about, yeah, connecting with the time and place in which your life is unfolding, being here now, and being able to recognize that our thoughts and emotions are transient experiences that will come, that are here, and will go. Then we move to the trunk of the tree, and that represents our ability to be willing. What do I mean by willing? Willing to recognize that our minds are story-generating machines. Our minds generate these scripts all of the time about who we are, what we think we're capable of, what other people might think of us. So we have to be willing to recognize that story-generating quality, and we have to be willing to be open and show up to the emotions that come with those stories, rather than being blocked or disencouraged by the presence of those emotions. We need to have those emotions and still do what matters. And then finally, the crown of the tree, the leaves and the branches, that represents our ability to be empowered. Just like the crown of the tree powers the tree, fuels it, we need to be empowered by our sense of purpose. So what it is that matters to us, and our personal values. How do we want to be in the world? What qualities do we want to exhibit and show when we interact with ourselves, when we interact with other people? So yeah, those three elements about being anchored, willing, and empowered are the three facets of psychological flexibility that I explore in the book. And I give the reader lots of opportunity to understand little practices, tools, techniques, strategies they can use to bring that more into their life.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Ross White about his book, The Tree That Bends, How a Flexible Mind Can Help You Thrive. Dr. White is a clinical psychologist based in the United Kingdom. And a little bit later, I want to talk to you a little bit about your own personal background. In fact, maybe this is as good a time as any to talk about that. You tell us that in this book, you are drawing upon not only your 15 years working as a clinical psychologist, but that this understanding, this perspective that you have also springs from where you grew up in the heart of Northern Ireland and what you experienced, I think, particularly early in your life. If you'd be so kind, I would appreciate you sharing with our listeners a little bit about this facet of, in a sense, where you come from and the way in which you feel that has shaped some of what you have come to understand about the ways that human beings interact, understand themselves and the world.
So I grew up in Northern Ireland in a small town called Moira in the valley of the River Lagan. And I grew up during what is commonly referred to as the Troubles, which was a period of sectarian violence between the mainly Catholic nationalist community and the mainly Protestant unionist community. And that resulted in nearly 3,000 people being murdered over a 30-year period. And I'm very proud of the fact that at the age of 21, I was able to vote in favor of the Good Friday Agreement, a referendum that brought an end to the Troubles and resulted in power sharing between the two communities in Northern Ireland. But I grew up witnessing the impact that prejudice, discrimination, and violence can have on people and their communities. So I got a good sense, Greg, of the role that rigidity can play when people get very dogmatic and the extent to which that impacts on their ability to be pragmatic. So I think from a very early age, I was aware of the potential importance of being psychologically flexible and not just trying to live your own life, but live alongside other people and other communities as well.
While we're dwelling on the personal, I wonder if you would mind taking a moment to talk about the person to whom the book is dedicated, an uncle of yours by the name of Tom White, who you tell us opened your eyes to the importance of thriving, of finding that means of learning how to thrive. If you don't mind, tell us about him and the kind of lessons that you learned about life from him.
I'm glad you asked, because it's always a pleasure to speak about Uncle Tom White. And sadly, he passed away in November of 2023. Just as I was finishing the first edition of the book. And that's why the book is dedicated to him. He was a man of poetry. He wrote his own poetry and published a number of books. And he was always very passionate about the importance of compassion. And he was very influenced by Buddhist ideals. And he really helped to open my eyes to the important role that that can play in helping people to live a good life. He was the first person within our family to go to university, and he studied the classics. So he was always very knowledgeable about philosophy. And I loved spending time with him. And he was actually living in Australia the first 10 years of my life, and returned to Northern Ireland whenever I was 11 years of age. It's such a formative age. And in addition to my parents, he was such a formative mentor in my upbringing and my development. And I loved having conversations with him, because they would be so wide-ranging and deep. And I miss the conversations. And yeah, that's why the book is dedicated to him.
Very good. So one of the things you say quite firmly at one point in the book is that this book is not a set of rules to be rigidly followed. And in clarifying what you mean by that, you tell us that the first rule of a flexible mind is hold rules more lightly. That's such an interesting way to think about it. And of course, somebody might react to that and say, well, that then they're not rules anymore. I mean, rules are something that you hold with an iron fist, and they give way to nothing. And this points to the possibility of thinking about rules and applying rules to ourselves and others in a way that holds them more lightly. Tell our listeners what you mean by that intriguing turn of phrase.
Yeah. Well, for me, context is so important. The particular situations that we find ourselves in, the other people that might be present, the stresses and pressures that we might be facing in those specific situations need to be taken into consideration. And I have some concern that rules are blind and it's flexibility that sees, because flexibility is about having a real eye to the context and thinking about pragmatism and this notion of workability and the function that our behaviors are intended to serve in the situation that we find ourselves in. And I work with a lot of high performance individuals, as I mentioned earlier, and I will not deny that qualities such as grit and relentlessness and conscientiousness are going to be important for us to achieve our goals. Absolutely, they will be. And if we are relentlessly relentless, we are going to burn out. So the qualities, the attributes, the traits that are going to be important in some contexts, whether it's in the gym, on the track, whether it's in the boardroom, aren't necessarily going to be so conducive in our homes, in the kitchen, when we're interacting with family members. So context matters, and that's this notion of flexibility. It's about ensuring that our approaches are tailored to the situations that we find ourselves in.
It's interesting how much terms matter, and the terms to which we gravitate, or the way in which we think about certain words, certain terminology. Early in the book, when you are kind of exploring this whole notion of the high performance life, of the drive for success, and you've already touched on some of these terms that tend to be bandied about, and often very carelessly, recklessly. No limits, resilience, mental toughness, grit. You take the time to explore each of those terms and the way in which we tend to understand what those qualities are. And of course, part of the point is the fact that, as you've just alluded to, we so often misuse those concepts or apply them in ways that are ultimately counterproductive. And it kind of brings you then into a conversation about a concept that I must confess I don't remember hearing about or reading about before, something that you tell us is called emotional granularity. And I think, if I understand correctly, it's kind of a concept related to something that maybe more of us have heard of called emotional intelligence. And you make reference to a book that even has that title. But I think the discussion you go into about emotional granularity is especially interesting and would be worth exploring for just a few minutes, because it seems to me that that really helps lead us then into some of the further layers that you take us to in this book.
Yeah, I think to understand emotions that we experience, it's really important for us to understand the nature of those experiences and to find ways of understanding them ourselves, but also ways of communicating effectively with others about them. So it concerns me sometimes that we don't spend enough time educating people about emotions and how we are hardwired to experience emotions. And I think sometimes emotions get reduced down to almost being like an inconvenience. Oh my goodness, they're getting in the way of you being productive. You know, that's not good. You got to get rid of that. I use this acronym TEAM, TEAM, treat emotions as messengers. Right? So emotions are there to serve important functions. For example, anger could be an indication that our rights are being infringed or that our integrity is being questioned, right? Sadness could be a result of a loss, something dear to us being no longer there. Fear could be an indication that we are under threat and that there's a risk of harm to us as individuals. So it's important for us to label these emotions, find ways of communicating about them, understanding the functions that they might serve, being willing to lean into the felt experience of those emotions to help people recognize that, well, in this moment, you can hold that emotion. In the next moment, you can hold that emotion. Would you be willing to have that emotion and still do the things that matter to you? And I'll emphasize that being willing to have the emotions is not the same as wanting them. Who would want to be fearful? Who would want to be angry? Who would want to be sad? But perhaps we can be willing to have those experiences in the service of the things that matter to us. So emotional granularity is part of that education around better understanding emotions so that we can understand the function of them and communicate better about them.
As I read your book, one of the things that occurred to me, and you touch on this a bit, is the notion of how much this can be a part of everyone's life. That is, to what extent do some people seem to be born with a mind that is in some ways naturally flexible? I mean, and that they are mentally and emotionally flexible, you know, without, for instance, reading your book or sitting down with a psychologist or whatever. They just, it just seems to be a rather natural part of who they are, versus other people who seem to be born with a mind that naturally operates in a very different way, in much more rigid fashion. And perhaps that's a misunderstanding on my part, that perhaps these differences in the way people operate in the world has more to do with the world and what they have experienced, and perhaps they have learned these behaviors. Drawing on your extensive experience, what is your sense of where this tends to originate? Does it tend to originate in the realm of nature versus nurture? And does that distinction perhaps even matter? But I mean, I guess, and the ultimate question is the flexibility that you are talking about truly within the reach of any human being?
Question, and I'm going to give you a very psychologist answer. It's both nature and nurture. We have innate temperaments, if you like, that can be shaped by experiences before our birth. In utero, for example, our genetic makeup, and we also are shaped by the experiences that we have through life in terms of some of the interpersonal relationships that we have, in terms of how our needs are met by significant caregivers at times in our lives, and the importance, for example, of attachment theory and secure versus insecure attachment. But even that is not set in stone. That continues to evolve and be shaped by the relationships we have throughout our lives. So as a psychologist, I am an optimist that there is always the potential for these skills to be developed. And the evidence backs that up, Greg. There have been extensive randomized controlled trials of interventions based on acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, that I mentioned earlier, that have evidenced changes in levels of psychological flexibility before and after the intervention. So yeah, the research backs up that perspective that these are skills that can be honed, that can be developed, that we can develop this psychological jujitsu, that we can become masters of it. Now, it's not a magic wand. It does require people to invest the time, energy, and effort to bring about those changes. And I like to say that I'm not a magician, but I can be a catalyst. I can be a catalyst to support people to make the changes that's going to increase that psychological flexibility in their lives.
I think one of the reasons that question came to mind is sort of takes us back to the initial point that for some people, just the whole notion of being a flexible person is sort of the last thing they want to be. It's a distasteful idea that it somehow is it involves weakness and so on. I mean, and you say very early in the book, your notion of flexibility is not about bending to the will of others. That is not what this is about. It's about a different kind of strength, maybe a more evolved sense of really what it means to be strong. And I think one of the things that I especially like about your book is that it really goes to a long way to transform our notions of what it means to be flexible. And the tremendous benefit that one might derive from that kind of flexibility, whether in the workplace or on the football field or whatever we're talking about. At one point, you say something that I think is especially helpful in this regard when you say, "A flexible mind allows us to make optimal choices." And that if one is not flexible, if whatever confronts you, if your response to it is going to be your knee-jerk, visceral response, chances are many, maybe most of those choices made in that kind of way are not going to be the best choices for you. Talk more about the way in which flexibility can be of such a great benefit to a person in this regard.
Yeah, in the book I talk about my bugbear around the use of the term comfort zone, because I think comfort zone actually belies the fact that there can be considerable discomfort caused in our lives, particularly in the longer term, when we make supposedly safe choices. So I don't use comfort zone, I use conforming zone. When we end up conforming to rigid ideas about what we're capable of, what we should do, what we can't do. And when we buy into those stories, we can find that life starts to feel small. It lacks vitality. It lacks that sense of fulfillment, of adventure, of growth, of development. So I think psychological flexibility is a great vehicle for helping people to make those optimal choices that help them to move from the conforming zone into what I call the transforming zone. Okay, so the potential for transformation within our lives around making optimal choices really opens the door to that sense of fulfillment, contentment, but it's not easy work. I would say that vulnerability is the price of admission to the transformation zone. If we're not prepared to put ourselves out on the skinny branches, we lose out on the chance to potentially taste the sweetest fruit. Okay, right? So, yeah, it's not easy to get out of that conforming zone into the transforming zone. But I hope that the tools, techniques, the strategies that I describe in the book are going to be helpful and useful for people doing that. So, yeah, my concern is that we end up making choices that feel familiar to us, that end up being suboptimal, that end up being out of habit, as opposed to us being vulnerable, courageous, and prepared to do the tough stuff. So flexibility to counter the concern you highlighted earlier that people will have, is not easy. It's not passive. It's this active, courageous willingness to have doubt, to have fear, to have sadness, and not be blocked by it, but continue in pursuit of your sense of purpose and making the contribution that you want to make to the world.
I think one point you make in the book that I could imagine some readers finding maybe a bit disconcerting and or intimidating is when you say that this notion of having a flexible mind is not referring to a particular mindset. And again, that's, I think for some people, their notion is going to be, well, when you have a flexible mind, that means this. It means this one thing. And probably I would think most people would say that a flexible mind means there's no rules, there's no black and white, there's no right and wrong, and, you know, you just go with the flow and whatever, loosey-goosey, whatever your terminology might be. And for some people, that might be a really distasteful way to make your way through life. And for other people, they might say, you know, I'm in environments or situations where that's just not appropriate at all, and that's not useful to me. But what one of the things you say in your book is that we're not talking about one particular mindset, that's what flexibility is, but rather it is the ability to flexibly explore, deploy different mindsets as our circumstances require. And I think for a lot of us, we feel like we go through life with essentially one mindset. This is who I am, and this is how I behave, this is how I think, this is how I feel. You are inviting people to think in a much more expansive terms about who they are.
Yeah, there's a risk that we end up typecasting ourselves in our own soap opera, that we end up confining ourselves to conforming to these notions of who we are, what we do. And this is not an appeal for people to abandon a sense of who they are, not at all. It's about getting clarity on who you are and what matters to you. And the empowered element of flexibility that I mentioned earlier, being clear on your sense of purpose, right? And cultivating that sense of purpose, being clear on your personal values and espousing those personal values in how you live your life. I think that really speaks to the philosophical idea of the good life and an authentic life, a life lived with integrity, being true to who we are, even in the face of the storms of that life will bring, not being blown off course, having the flexibility to have those emotional storms and look to your sense of purpose and your personal values for how you want to be in the world. So yeah, I would hope that it equips people to live more authentically, to live with greater integrity, and to find ways of navigating some of the tricky complexities that life will throw at us.
I'm just curious, for you, as you make your way through the world and as you work with people and so on, you are also living your own life as a human being. And I wonder if there are certain aspects of this notion of being flexible that for you are especially challenging. Or maybe another way to think of the question, if it's helpful, is can you chart for us maybe one aspect of this in which you have managed to grow over the years from a state of being not quite so flexible to finding ways to become more flexible? I mean, are there aspects of this that have been, in a sense, more of a stretch for you, more of a challenge?
All of it. And I think I would be inauthentic if I said anything else. And if I'm going to help other people understand psychological flexibility and the difference it can make, it's really important for me, in terms of my values, to be really authentic about speaking from that lived experience of it myself. So writing this book is a very good example of that, Greg. This was a different book for me. This was with what's referred to as a trade publisher. So historically, my writing would have been for academic journals or academic textbooks, manuals for practitioners like other psychologists. So I deliberately wanted to challenge myself to take all of this knowledge that I had acquired through my career and to spread the word so that people out there in Joe Public, general population, can avail of these insights and the tools that will help build on those insights. But that was hugely confronting for me because the role in writing this kind of book is not just to educate, it's to entertain. If you do not hold the reader's attention, you could have the best material, the most insightful material in the world, but it wouldn't amount to anything because people won't read it. So it was a real challenge for me to find my authorial voice, to engage the reader, to entertain the reader, to retain their interest. And there were moments of huge doubt around that. Would it all come together in a coherent way? Would I get the balance between insight, tools, and entertainment correct? So there were moments of doubt that, yeah, I recall very deeply and wondered whether this was all a big misadventure. But I hope that I was able to prevail, to have that doubt and still commit to doing what I felt was important with this book.
I want to finish by talking about the matter of focus and attention, which you were just sort of speaking in adjacent fashion to just now. You talk at one point saying the reality is that the present moment is the only place where we can exercise choice and agency. But you go on then to talk about the very common phenomenon of mind wandering. And the way in which many of us suffer from distraction. I think as you discuss this, one of the most interesting points you make is when you kind of take us to task for assuming that this crisis of attention that a lot of people like to talk about has everything to do with our current digital technologies and we're staring at our phones and our screens and so on. But you go on to say that there have been concerns about a human being's capacity for focus and attention that have been around for literally thousands of years. And so we need to be really careful not to carelessly assign blame to things like the devices we hold in our hands. Yes, they are part of the problem, but you are speaking of something that is even deeper within us that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, I talk in the book about the example of monks, medieval monks, who were noted to be experiencing a set of symptoms that really sort of plated around this notion of them not having the attention that they ought to have. And one of the contributing factors to this particular issue that was flagged in the Middle Ages was the newest technology on the block. It was the new kit on the block that was identified as being a contributing factor to this issue. And what was that? Books. Books. They were the ones who were blessed with the teaching and the ability, therefore, to read and to write. And it was recognized that spending so much time buried in books may not be that conducive to people's social functioning and effective interaction between the monks. So it's really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, we do identify the new stuff that's coming as being problematic. And yeah, it can be part of the problem, but it can also be part of the cure. We have to recognize that behind every mobile phone, there's maybe 100,000 people who have contributed to the development of that product to capture my attention and to hold my attention. So we just got to know that sometimes it can be stacked against us in that way. But I emphasize in the book that it's important for our attention to wander. Our attention needs to flex. Sometimes it's going to be incredibly helpful for us to mind wander, and that can indeed lead to creative ideas. Some of the best ideas I had for the book came when I was out walking with Bobby the dog, and yeah, my mind would wander and suddenly the answers would appear. Whereas if I had sat in front of the computer browbeating myself to come up with the solution, it wouldn't have. So persistence is not the cure for an ailing attention. Sometimes we need to get up and mix it. Sometimes doing a little game or some doodle on your phone is just what you need to allow yourself to replenish your attentional forces so you can go again.
That reminds me of one of my favorite moments, which is towards the very end of the book, when you say flexibility is about feeling it all. Whatever you're feeling isn't wrong. It doesn't need to be fixed, swapped out, suppressed, or avoided. Your understood as an experience that you have rather than an experience that has you. An experience that helps to highlight what you care about, and an experience that you can respond to in line with your purpose and personal values. Indeed, it is about resisting the urge to reductively judge emotions as being either positive or negative. There can be learning.
I saw a quote from you a while back where you said that you don't write Christian
songs. Well, that insight and many, many more are to be found in this endlessly fascinating book called The Tree That Bends, How a Flexible Mind Can Help You Thrive, published by Quercus, a division of Hachette, and the author, Dr. Ross White. Thank you, Dr. White, for giving the world this wonderful book, and thank you so much for being my morning show guest today. It was a true pleasure to speak with you.
Pleasure is all mine. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and thank you for reading the book so attentively and for asking the questions that you did.
It is now 8:59. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. We are your gateway to public radio, and we are Wisconsin Public Radio for southeastern Wisconsin. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for the news and then Wisconsin Today in just a little bit. Let's get you the forecast now from the National Weather Service. Still some snow on the way, it appears. The official forecast says light, slushy snow developing later this morning and continuing into the afternoon. Could see 1 to 2 inches of possible accumulation. Today's high 35. Tonight, sunset 549, a low of 23. Pretty good weekend. Saturday, sunny and 46. Sunday, sunny and 53. Now 34 degrees in both.